is the news.
Iran rules out any bilateral talks with the U.S. on the 2015 nuclear deal, calling on Washington to live up to its commitments under the accord. Myanmar's de facto leader calls for protests against the military coup after the army detains senior officials and declares a state of emergency. Police in Belgium and Austria make scores of arrests as thousands of people rally to protest COVID-19 restrictions and lockdowns. Tom Behrouz, Najafi, good to have you with us. Iran has once again emphasized its stance on the 2015 nuclear deal, stressing that Tehran is awaiting Washington's action.
Iran is waiting for the U.S. to act, which means the removal of sanctions effectively. We want to see all sanctions are lifted, which former U.S. President Donald Trump had imposed on Iran in violations of international laws and accords, including UN Security Council Resolution 2231 and the JCPOA.
Fatehzadeh said that it would not be sufficient to see some developments on paper. Rather, Tehran wants to see sanctions lifted in real. The spokesman also ruled out any bilateral talks with the U.S. on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He urged the new U.S. administration to correct the wrongdoings of his predecessor. The spokesman says that Iran will return to its full compliance with the JCPOA commitments only after those requirements are met. The Iranian president says that the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a global manifestation of the country's social assets. Hassan Rouhani was speaking at a mausoleum of the late founder of the Islamic Republic. He said that Imam Khomeini toppled the U.S.-backed regime of Pahlavi through relying on the people's power. Iran is holding 10-day celebrations marking the 42nd anniversary of the triumph of the Islamic Revolution. Every year, people commemorate the occasion by holding ceremonies and events nationwide. The revolution emerged victorious on the 11th of February, 1979.
Iran has kicked off the annual celebrations, marking the anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The nationwide celebrations start on the anniversary of the homecoming of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, after several years of exile, and ends on the anniversary of the victory of the revolution. As of every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. Located south of the capital, Tehran, the mausoleum hosts senior Iranian officials as well as ordinary people, especially on the first day of the celebrations.
Like every year, we came here in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country, a man who led Iranians toward their ideals.
Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. People sought to establish a new political system that was based on their will and Islamic values. And that was the Islamic Republic.
The Islamic Republic means that a Muslim nation like Iran needs to have an Islamic institution and an Islamic lifestyle. During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us, something which was not accepted by our people.
To me, as a person who has not seen the revolution, such ceremonies can help acquaint me with the character of Imam Khomeini and what led Iranians to rise against the Shah.
This year, authorities in charge of the 10-day ceremonies say no mass gatherings will be allowed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Instead of public celebrations, Mehrabad Airport hosted a motorcycle parade by Iran's armed forces. Through the route Imam Khomeini took from the airport in 1979, as millions of people flocked to the streets to welcome him.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence. Those voices have echoed through the decades and have been heard by different generations. This year, the occasion is marked without mass celebrations amid the coronavirus pandemic. But organizers say the message is the same. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Myanmar's ruling National League for Democracy party says its leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has urged the public to protest against the military coup. The party says that Suu Kyi suspects the military will once again put the country under dictatorship. The military declared a one-year state of emergency and said that power has been handed over to the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Suu Kyi and other senior figures were detained in the early morning raid. There are also communication blackouts, and soldiers are patrolling outside the city hall in the largest city, Yangon. The coup and detentions come after days of escalating tensions between the government and the military. The generals claimed that the last parliamentary elections were fraudulent. The Muang Zarni, a Burmese academic in exile, says that a military coup in Myanmar was not out of expectation because it's still a fragile democracy that's largely controlled by the generals.
This is expected primarily because we have had in the last 10 years a situation where Western governments and UN and pretty much the whole world accepted this farce or farcical perception that Myanmar is a fragile democracy, transition is fragile under Aung San Suu Kyi, so don't rock the boat. But the fact is, Myanmar is still very much controlled by the military, and that military has adopted a constitution which they wrote themselves, and they adopted it, and the constitution legalizes military coup.
International reactions are pouring in over detention of Myanmar's de facto leader and other political figures during a military coup. The United Nations has strongly condemned the detentions and urged Myanmar's military to respect the will of the people. Washington called for the immediate release of detained officials, warning the Myanmar's military of a response from the United States. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and EU officials denounced a coup in the Southeast Asian country. Australia, Japan, Indonesia, and China also reacted, calling for a lawful and peaceful resolution to the crisis. Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims, who have taken refuge in neighboring Bangladesh, slammed the coup and called for international assistance for the restoration of democracy. Indian police have beefed up security and blocked main roads leading to the capital, New Delhi, in an effort to prevent protesting farmers from entering the city. Police and paramilitary forces have dug up trenches and put razor wires on highways as the finance minister is set to deliver annual budget plan in parliament. Security is stepped up around parliament building and other public premises. There are also internet and communication blackouts in several neighborhoods. And these moves come days after a tractor rally by farmers on Indians Republic Day turned violent, with some ralliers storming into the capital's iconic Red Fort. Farmers have been protesting for months, demanding the government repeal a set of agricultural laws. The government rejects the call, arguing that reform is aimed at boosting rural economies. Let's now take a look at Europe. Belgians have staged protest rallies in the capital, Brussels, to express their discontent with government-imposed lockdown measures. Demonstrators defied a ban on gatherings and marched through several districts. Minor scuffles broke out between police and protesters. Officials say that more than 200 people were arrested during the rallies. In October, the government placed a nighttime curfew and restrictions on public places, trying to stem the spread of the coronavirus. The demonstrators called for the immediate lifting of all bans.
I am here because I think it is not right at all what is going on, just because of a virus that doesn't kill that many people. Now, people are dying, starving. They can't work and earn money, so I don't find that normal.
Now, anger is prevailing in several other European countries against COVID-related lockdowns and restrictions. Polish police raided public places that defied restrictions while violent protests erupted in the Dutch capital, with police clashing with demonstrators. Europe is bracing for a new wave of infections in the coming months. France has already closed its borders to non-European countries. Germany has barred travelers from countries battling with the COVID variants. A two-week ban on foreign travel also took effect in Portugal on Sunday. Elsewhere in Europe, thousands of Austrians have taken to the streets of Vienna to protest COVID-19 restrictions and lockdowns. The demonstration was held without police permission, leading to numerous arrests. Omar Lesky has more.
An estimated 5,000 people take part in another massive demonstration in Vienna against COVID restrictions, this time without police permission.
Police had banned all major demonstrations planned for the weekend across the federal capital. Meanwhile, the Archdiocese of Vienna had warned of a corona demonstration disguised as a Christian procession.
Police forces reported numerous arrests as demonstrators defied calls to disperse, to keep the required distance, and to wear face masks. Protesters called the government-imposed lockdown dictatorial and argued it wouldn't work in stopping the virus's spread.
I want to live in peace with everyone. I want to work. We want to enjoy our life that is given from God.
So the people are going crazy, people have to work. If you don't die from virus, you die from hunger, because the people have no money. Everything is closed. It's crazy.
The Sunday rally had been proposed by the right-wing opposition Freedom Party, the FPÖ. The demonstration was among 15 banned by authorities to avoid any major danger to public health. And although party leaders called for compliance, their supporters still turned up. Local media also reported the presence of far-right and neo-Nazi groups. The ruling party said the FPÖ had reached a new low by embracing right-wing extremists and coronavirus deniers. Austria's third hard lockdown is expected to end on the 7th of February, and while trade unions warn of mass bankruptcy if the country doesn't reopen, virologists say the current number of infections is still too high. Authorities are counting on further vaccination and a test, trace, and isolate policy to keep the situation under control. Homolezki, Vienna.
In other news, at least hundreds of Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have tested positive for coronavirus, and this amid Israel's defiance of international calls to respect basic rights of Palestinians and provide them with medical care during pandemic. Mona Kandil reports from the West Bank.
With Israel's failure to contain the spread of coronavirus in Israel and the Palestinian-occupied territories, at least 200 Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails tested positive in January, bringing the total number of Palestinian prisoners who have been infected with the coronavirus to more than 350, according to Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Commission. The commission accused the Israeli Prison Administration of depriving the Palestinian inmates of medical care. The commission also said the increase of cases among the Israeli soldiers was the first source of a transmission of the virus to the Palestinian prisoners.
We are following with great concern the spread of the virus among the Palestinian prisoners. We hold Israel accountable for the health of the Palestinian inmates. Israel must respect international law.
During a protest held in support of the Palestinian prisoners in the occupied city of Ramallah, Palestinian officials and prisoner rights groups called on the international bodies to intervene and put an end to the medical negligence practiced by the Israeli Prison Administration against Palestinian prisoners. They say Israel must vaccinate the estimated 4,500 Palestinians held in its jails against COVID-19.
Today, the international community must step in and save the lives of our Palestinian inmates. Israel must be held accountable for its crimes and policies toward the prisoners. This should be done through global pressure on Israel.
Israel has already begun to vaccinate its population. This comes as the regime denies Palestinians in the occupied lands of the vaccine. International rights groups have slammed Israel for the move, calling on it to remain faithful to its commitments under international treaties. Under the Geneva Conventions, Israel must provide vaccines not only to prisoners held in its jails, but also to those living under its occupation in the West Bank and also in the besieged Gaza Strip. This definitely is raising political and public health questions about Israel's responsibilities to the Palestinians as an occupying regime. Muna Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Now let's take a look at the U.S. The death toll from the coronavirus there has surpassed 441,000. That's after 1,700 more people succumbed to the disease. According to Johns Hopkins University, 110,000 new cases were also reported in a day. And that brings the total cases to 26.2 million. The U.S., the world's worst country by the pandemic, is also struggling to contain the spread of the new strains of the virus. Researchers predicting that the new strains could cause a deadly spike across the United States this spring. Yemen has held Italy's decision to stop arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The Yemeni Minister of Human Rights, however, says that what matters most is an end to the Saudi war and the lifting of the blockade. In Sana'a, Abdullatif al-Washali has more.
Italy has decided to stop arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to restore peace in Yemen and to protect human rights. The decision cancels deals to sell 12,700 missiles to Saudi Arabia and billions of dollars in other weapons to the UAE.
We hope this decision will be implemented. Though late, it highlights the seriousness of what Yemenis have been subject to in terms of death and destruction caused by such weapons exported to Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and other countries participating in the aggression against Yemen.
The Ministry of Human Rights praised the Italian decision and described it as positive but late, calling on the rest of the countries supporting the Saudi-led coalition to stop supplying weapons, stressing that what is more important is to stop the war and lift the siege that has caused more deaths than weapons have.
We remember that lately some countries such as Spain and Germany decided to temporarily stop selling weapons to Saudi Arabia and then retreated, perhaps due to political pressure. We expect that after these popular campaigns, there will be wider decisions in the rest of the countries as well. We need the war and siege to be stopped in order to save the lives of women and children.
These decisions came after 6 years of war and siege imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition on Yemen, which violated international human rights law by targeting civilians, including women and children, and led to the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the United Nations.
Yemenis hope that the rest of the countries will stop their support for the Saudi-led coalition and that these decisions will be the first real steps toward ending the continuous suffering since the beginning of war in 2015. Abdullatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Russia is accusing the European Union of pursuing double standard regarding Moscow in the wake of police response to recent rallies in that country. The Russian first deputy prime representative of the UN criticized the EU for failing to denounce what he called disproportionate use of force against protesters in the bloc's member states. Dmitry Polyansky says that police in Austria, France, and the Netherlands have used brute force in response to the recent rallies there. The reaction came after EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said that Russia has resorted to widespread detentions and disproportionate use of force against rallies and journalists. Several Russian cities have witnessed rallies in the past days over the detention of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Hundreds have been arrested during the demonstrations, which the Kremlin called unauthorized. Well, that's all I had for you in this broadcast.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Today, I'm visiting one of the beautiful parks of Tehran. The beautiful Chitgar Forest Park in the west of the capital city is our today's destination. Chitgar Forest Park, with an area of 950 hectares of land, is one of the biggest parks of Tehran. Chitgar Forest Park is divided into the eastern and western parts. The western part includes parking, pergolas, restaurants and coffee shops, as well as a cycling loop. The length of this cycling loop is 6 kilometers. In the eastern part also, there are cycling and horse riding loops. Chitgar Lake is located adjacent to this park. The flora of this park is diverse. 53% of the trees include Eldarica pine, Arizona cypress, and Platycladus orientalis. Also, about 47% of this park's trees are broadleaf trees, including robinia, common ash, elm, maple, and oak. I am now in Chitgar Park. It's sunny and most suitable for hiking. There are a lot of families here who have come for a tour, a hike, or exercising. Some people are walking, some others are running, and I can see a team of youths here who are playing volleyball. Chitgar Park has one of the best cycling loops of Tehran. I am now at the beginning of the long-distance cycling route. On my right side, there is the fast cycling route where professional cyclists ride. And here I am where the bikes are rented. There are different types of bikes here. Bikes for children or adults, tandem bikes, and triplet cycles. Very interesting. And I am now on the eastern side of the park, and here I am in a manege. Here is an enclosed area in which horses and riders are trained. Wow, what a beautiful black horse. I wish I had brought some sugar cubes with myself. Horses love sugar. Walking in Chitgar Park is really enjoyable. Oh, look at there! A gray fox with a long, pretty tail. Oh, well, my loud voice scared the poor animal and it ran away. Ah, what a pity. In Chitgar Park, there are also squirrels, Mina, and Magpie. I can't stop walking in such a beautiful park. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, in November of last year, a controversial bill was drafted in France which would prevent journalists from filming police during arrests. Now, people have regularly taken to the streets in Paris and other cities to demand that the law does not come into effect this January. Will protesters be able to keep this from becoming law, and what they say would take away the checks and balances to help prevent police abuse and brutality? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate.
Protesters have taken to the streets in dozens of French cities against a security bill they say will restrict the filming and publicizing of images of police brutality. Demonstrators said the draft legislation will lead to more censorship and less freedom.
This bill has one objective, to allow a surveillance of the territory by drones. We are, of course, against the ban for journalists to film and to publish pictures of police officers. They want to prevent the publication of footage of police violence. The citizens say we don't want this law at all.
A total of 70 groups, including the Yellow Vests, organized the protest. Protesters said the new law opens the door to a generalized surveillance of the population, the use of drones, and the ban to film police officers.
French people have been the victim of police violence for a long time, in the suburbs more than elsewhere. There is more and more violence during demonstrations. The citizens should understand that we are here to defend their future liberty and the right to film. They must be able to show the judges that sometimes there is police violence. Pictures are sometimes the only evidence.
Footage of white police officers beating up a black music producer in his Paris studio on November 21 has fueled anger over the legislation, condemned by many as signaling a swing to the right by President Emmanuel Macron.
We've got for a lot of years now in France a lot of discussions about identity checks, which are very more likely to be happening to young people, to men, and to men with different backgrounds from origin, Arabic people and black people. So this kind of systematic background checks and identity checks, it participates to a state racism in France, especially about the police, and so we are fully supporting the Amnesty report.
Last week, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and four other rights groups warned that they will file a lawsuit against the French government for what they called systematic discrimination by police officers carrying out identity checks. Even French President Macron admitted recently that there was a problem of discrimination during identity checks. The new security bill will be debated in the French Senate in about 1 month. Some senators declared they want to rewrite the bill, but most protesters here simply want to abrogate it. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of New York, journalist and author Daniel Lazar, and out of London from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in New York. And Daniel, I mean, why do you think the French government has proposed such a law at this time?
Yeah, Macron is under great pressure from the far right, from the National Front of Marine Le Pen. In order to hold her off, he's adopted a policy of trying to co-opt her program by toughening up the police and toughening up state responses to protests and demonstrators, and using generally more punitive measures. I mean, France is feeling the strain of COVID, the pandemic, and a severe, savage economic contraction. Tempers are rubbed raw, conflict is rising, and the state feels it has no choice but to respond in a militant manner, and that's the only way Macron knows to hold off the challenge from those even further to the right.
Well, what about that, Reza? I mean, Daniel said tempers right now are raw, it's sensitive, they're under a lot of pressure, but as a matter of fact, isn't that even more of a reason to make sure that there are checks and balances on things in France?
I think one of the things that is happening with this particular law is this whole idea of making sure that any police brutality that's carried out is not going to be filmed. And this is particularly something that is conducive or signals that what we're seeing is the emergence of a police state and the different powers that it actually has as a result of it. Because if you don't, on the other hand, we've seen also that many police authorities, police people on the streets and on the front lines are actually carrying cameras and so on in which they can film what's actually going on. And this allows for making sure for there to be accountability. What we're seeing with this is that accountability will be selectively chosen. And where needed, evidence can be disposed of by the police officers, if need be. And in this particular case, what we're talking about is a serious infringement on rights. It's not just about the fact that there's a lot of pressure and so on. We've seen this kind of deliberate move mm-hmm. over years and decades in this direction. What we're seeing also is that this is something that is very much reminiscent of what used to happen and what was certainly talked about in terms of happening in the Soviet Union kind of spheres of influence, in particular the Stasi police state of East Germany. And so what we're seeing is very much a reemergence of some of those ideas and some of those natural things being put in place. Mm-hmm. And it's got a label of democracy on top of it to try and sweeten what is actually being done. So I think there are some serious issues that are there, and France needs to be called out for what it is, that it is going in the direction of a police state, and that's what it's about.
Well, Daniel, I mean, during this period of great dissatisfaction of the French people towards their government, doesn't this type of law simply make the Macron government even less popular than it already is. I know you talked about trying to appeal to the far right and Le Pen and those who follow her, but in general, as far as looking at the overall French electorate, couldn't this be dangerous for the government itself?
It certainly could be, yes, but I think that Macron believes he has more to gain than to lose through this kind of policy. He's trying to appeal to the conservative part of the French electorate, which is fed up with disorders in the streets, wants a tougher police response, and if it doesn't get it from Macron, it'll turn to the National Front and Marine Le Pen. So that's the game Macron is playing. He's trying to carve out a base for himself in an angry right of center electorate, and he's hoping to succeed. So we'll see what happens. But unfortunately, if Macron loses, we could very easily see power slip into the hands of the National Front, and that would be, of course, an even greater disaster. Not that I'm trying to make excuses for Macron or in any way justify his policies, because I'm not.
Okay. Well, Reza, immediately following the proposal of this law back in November, a video went viral in France showing a black music producer being brutalized by French police. Do you think that this has played any role in getting more people on the streets to protest against this law? And what could have happened in that same case if there had not been any film of the situation?
I think to answer your first question, it's quite clear that in any kind of law enforcement situation where there is no evidence to suggest and there's no one from within the police who were involved in that process of brutalizing an individual that they are seeking to arrest or seeking to question or whatever, then the police inevitably have backed each other's stance or have gone quiet and not said anything against their own colleague in terms of the repercussions they might have within the policing fraternity and their careers and so on. So this is something that needs to be understood, that this is something that is very much there. And in terms of problems within this actually being filmed in terms of happening to a black individual, I think the problem that people are seeing, that once this goes out, that with any kind of injustice that is going to be coming into the forefront and going to be legislated in this way, then inevitably things that are targeted at minorities, be they Arab or black or whatever, in this case, the instance you're talking about is a black individual being targeted in this way. What people here have recognized from the white community in France is that this could be something that will give police powers that are beyond something that they are prepared to accept. But we need to understand the racial element that exists within this context, and in particular within the context of France. We're talking about a country that is deeply racist in terms of its attitudes towards people, institutionally racist in many of its institutions, and that's something that is put out there, and it's something that comes up regularly in terms of how that institutional racism is also impacting on the racist attitudes of ordinary people in the country. And I think that's something that needs to be recognized and said for what it is, that is what the problem is and that is what's going on. So there is different layers, if you like, to that.
Well, Daniel, in your perspective, how common is police brutality in France anyway?
It's very hard to answer that kind of question because evidence is very hard to obtain. There's a code of silence among police officers, and very often a criminal case boils down to an individual cop's word against an individual defendant's word. So it's difficult to prove, and it's difficult to know. It's kind of the phenomenon is kind of in a black box.
So with that being said, I mean, wouldn't the government know to begin with that there's definitely going to be backlash in suggesting something like that that would not be in the benefit of the average citizen.
Well, because the government thinks that maybe in balance it'll be politically beneficial to the government. That, in other words, that more citizens will approve of this policy than disapprove of this policy. Yes, you know, a certain vocal element is taken to the street, in my opinion, to protest this move towards police authoritarianism, but they're not the entire electorate. And so therefore, some portion of the electorate may approve of these measures, may approve of a tougher police response. That is Macron's gamble. That's what he's trying to do. So we don't know how it will play out. Certainly in the United States, police violence is a massive problem, completely out of control. The citizen, many people are up in arms over it, but many people support a tougher police response. So this is what the political struggle is all about.
Indeed. Well, Raza, there have been growing complaints by many French of increasing surveillance by security forces in the country. Why is it, on the one hand, the government increases surveillance techniques against the people, and on the other hand, Paris doesn't want journalists to keep watch over police?
I think in terms of the direction that they want to go in, that they want that surveillance to be something that they can use and weaponize for their own political ends. It's not about something where the police should be a force, an institution that actually works for the community in terms of making sure that policing takes place in a sensible and a way that brings confidence into the community. But when the state goes about these kind of things, where they increase surveillance, where they reduce the ability of the ordinary citizen to challenge the police, even by filming some brutality or whatever that might be taking place, then what you're doing is increasing, as I said before, the idea of creating a police state and continuing down that route. And when we talk about one of the three phrases that is often associated with France, and it's something that is very much part of the publicity relations exercise that France carries out internationally about liberté, as it calls it, it's quite, I think it's a bit of a joke that they dare to say that about anything that happens in any other country around the world in terms of policing, considering the direction that they're actually going in. And I think that one of the first things that needs to be said about this, that France is a police state. It's not about liberté, fraternité, et cetera, et cetera. It is about reducing the rights of individuals and citizens. And in answer to your question, it's about weaponizing surveillance and for it to be used as a tool when it suits the French political establishment, whichever strand of it, it may well be interested in a particular direction that it wants to go in. And so it's all part of that those same machinations.
Daniel, your take on what Reza just said, because yes, France likes to brag about its democratic roots and having liberty for all of its citizens. Has it simply become a slogan with the reality being something very far from the truth?
Unquestionably. Yes. That's sort of the story for much of modern French history. France as a country, it's a large urban country with a swelling underclass, many of them immigrants or racial minorities. There's crime. There's a war on drugs, whose impact in terms of undermining civil liberties can't be underestimated, can't be overestimated. France is subject to the same authoritarian tendencies of every other advanced industrial state on Earth, including the U.S., Britain, Germany, etc. And they, all of them, are drifting in a more and more overt authoritarian direction as the social crisis, the economic crisis, intensifies. And that That crisis is already acute. I think it's going to get worse and worse in the coming period. And these governments are responding by unleashing the police, adopting more punitive measures. That seems to be the direction that they are heading in.
Reza, your take, same question. Do you think that, what's the reasons in your perspective that countries like France is going towards a more authoritarian way?
Yeah, I mean, if we come across from France, across the English Channel, and come to Britain itself, we need to understand that what was pejoratively, derogatively looked at institutionally in terms of what the police had actually done in terms of infiltrating and abusing the communities and so on in the way that surveillance was actually carried out, in the way that abuses took place within that policing context. What we are now seeing is that police are being asked and told that they will be protected under law by laws being passed which will allow them to carry out these actions, and they'll be protected. So it's one law that will be applied to the police, there'll be another law that will be applied to the ordinary person. And what we are seeing is that as this direction actually continues, the idea of more and more countries and more ideas of the police state being entrenched in different sections of the law, the establishment, the institution, the more problems ordinary people are actually going to have. It's going to start off by targeting racial minorities. It will start off by targeting people who are, who have some kind of communities that are disadvantaged and so on. And inevitably, as it happens with, and there are plenty of examples, going back to the terrorism laws and so on that were started at the beginning of this century in the UK, which have gone on to target ordinary people, the wider white community. And this is something that is very much going to be happening here. And this culture stems from this idea that the end justifies the means. The principles are not even being paid lip service to. That philosophy is not something that is acceptable.
Daniel, do you think at the end of the day that this law is going to be implemented? Because as we're saying, there has been a lot of blowback, but as you also said, there are those who actually support it. So your assessment at the end of the day, will it pass or not?
My assessment is that it will pass, that Macron thinks it's very important. Macron thinks he's got to show that he has a strong hand, that he will not be cowed, that he's resolute, and that he is he's determined to hold off a challenge from the radical right. So I think in the end it will become law.
And Reza, your prognosis, near future of France, we're going to see a continual deterioration of rights for citizens and others?
I think that's inevitable. I think that's, if you chart it, before the idea was that the concept of liberty and so on was actually talked about and brandished about around the world, it's something that is being done in France to actually keep on emphasizing these concepts and so on. But actually what has been going on, if you chart the history, and it's just not just in France, it's happening in Britain as well in terms of what the rights are going to be, what people can and can't do, and how the spaces in which people can actually express themselves and have legitimate freedoms to actually be able to express discontent and to be able to protest, all of those things are being squeezed so that the net effect is the reduction of people to be able to say something. And that is very much reminiscent of a police state and fascism. And I think, unfortunately, while they might call it democracies, that's the direction that things are actually going in.
And it seems, unfortunately, history continues to repeat itself. On that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. Daniel Lazar out of New York, journalist and author, and Reza Kazem from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London. Appreciate you both being with us. And as always, nice to have you with us on another debate, and hope that you will join us right here, same time tomorrow.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, I greet you with the Islamic peace greeting. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to another program of questions and answers on the Islamic belief. I am your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi. And in the studio, we have our dear scholar, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi. Sayyid Muhsin, assalamu alaikum and welcome to our studio.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
Let's dive straight into the question, Sayyid. And that is from one of our dear listeners. He or she has asked, how come that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us that He loves us, mankind, and at the same time, we see torture, pain, diseases, and a lot of other calamities, and is this just a play for God? Are we a scene
of clay and game for God. Why did God even create us? What is the purpose of our creation?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, before the human beings, Allah had many creations. For example, He created the angels who never commit sin, who never feel tired, being tired. And
infallible beings.
They're infallible beings. On top of that, like other than them, Allah has created animals who just eat, walk, increase in the generations, obviously.
And praise Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Praise Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They all praise Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So these were two different things.
And then we have the jinns.
The jinns as well. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created humans with the intellect. With the intellect, with the fitrah. Now what Allah has done is Allah has merged the characteristics of the angels and animals into one creation that is known as
the human being.
And He said to this human being that you are greater than the angels. Why? Because angels obey what I say.
Because of your free will.
But I'm giving you one thing extra, that is free will. That you can freely choose to do good or bad. Now, in the question, when they say, like, we are bearing the pains.
So we can conclude that angels do not have a free will.
Angels do not have the free will, yes. Now, when in the question they ask, like, they say, we have grief, we have pain, we have all these things that are that we bear in this world. We need to remember that all these things are because of our own selves, not because of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Why? Because, for example, if I excessively eat, what's going to happen to my body? If I do not exercise, what's going to happen to my body? The way we are. For example, we are working whole day in the office. We are sitting behind the desk. And after a couple of days, I see my belly is growing. Why is it? Why am I am having a back pain? So basically, we do not have a balanced life. We do not act balancedly in our life. And that is the main reason. If we say, for example, someone passes away, my dearest friend, or from the children or parents or like the relatives, and that is a painful thing for me, but that is, you know, something natural, because He has created us, He has sent us in this world for the trial, and we need to be transferred to another world. These are not the parts of the, you know, the griefs that we can count.
So these calamities that are inflicted upon us are all from our own hands, basically.
These are from all on our hands.
God
does, yes.
Hasn't made this scene so you can sit back and enjoy the two gladiators fighting each other.
No, it's not like that.
Or two guys in UFC in a cage fighting each other. But He has created us to be elevated in spirituality, to live in peace and joy and happiness. And we are the ones who, because of our greed and our free will, are inflicting pain upon each other.
Yes, it is because of the human beings themselves. Because if we look at the history of the humans, they can clearly see that humans are doing this. In the nature, if today we can see diseases and all those things, for example, especially this coronavirus that is going on, obviously people have must read different articles on this. Where does this started from? It's because of the human beings, the laboratories, the tests that were made, obviously. Obviously, humans have something, obviously, and that is known as intellect. It wants to, or it is, human is growing intellectually, basically, in the scientific fields, and he has to grow in the spiritual field as well. But in the scientific field, when they are doing experiments, different experiments, obviously, they are just doing experiment. And these experiments can be obviously successful and unsuc-